my pleasure to introduce Alberto Cattaneo, who will tell us an introduction to the BB formalism.
Okay, thanks for the invitation. Thanks for being here. So I will give you this introduction, actually, since I'm two lectures planned, 1 hour today, 1 hour tomorrow. I will try to go a bit carefully, always explain some details, including some details of the BB formalism that probably are known to maybe two-thirds or more of the people here, but I will probably just introduce them again at the beginning, and also, well, to warm up and to fix my notation. And I mean, I think probably already this afternoon we could also start having discussions if you have more questions about the first part. Okay, so maybe let me give you a motivation for all of this. So this program, the program started with Pavel Hniov, who will be here from tomorrow, and Nikolai Rashetikin. So the idea is to try to formulate a T.S. Segal axioms for perturbative field theory. So can I also use Blackwell B2 complete? So, I mean, I think probably you know about T.S. Segal axiom, but just let me recall. So Segal has some idea of how quantum field theory should be formulated, mimicking what happens in quantum mechanics. So in quantum mechanics, you just have one worksheet dimension, which is time. Time is typically an interval. And so to an interval, you associate your evolution. So classically, you associate something to the, well, both classical and quantum mechanics, you associate something to the endpoint and something to the interval. So classically, the thing you associate to the endpoints are typically symplectic manifold, typically cotangent bundle of some manifold. And to the interval itself, you associate evolution. And quantum mechanics, to the endpoints, you associate Hilbert spaces, and to the interval itself, you associate an operator, usually a unitary operator. And well, since quantum mechanics is not topological, the length of the interval matters. So that the length of the interval is the time that lapses from the beginning to the end, and then you have the evolution operator for the corresponding time. And the important thing is that both classical and quantum mechanics, you have composition law. In classical mechanics, you have the Hamiltonian flow, which is a flow. So the flow of the sum of the two intervals is the composition of the flows. And in quantum mechanics, also the same. The composition of the two evolution operators is the evolution operator for the total amount of time. So grammatically, this means that you can put in another interval and glue the data over here. And then the generalization quantum field theory, let me do it a two-dimensional example. You might think of having some surface, and then basically Segal quantum field theory should be formalized as follows. Again, we have a manifold with boundary. Now it could be more complicated, just an interval. But each boundary component, you should associate, well, you find these already in quantum mechanics. So to each boundary component, you should associate some Hilbert space. And to the bulk itself, you should associate an operator between the Hilbert space corresponding to incoming boundary to the Hilbert space corresponding to outgoing boundary. And again, you have composition. But in this case, composition is a bit more complicated than this. Basically, I can compose with another surface whose outgoing boundaries are the same as the incoming boundary of the upper one. And then the idea that I know, compose. And so the statement is that the evolution operator corresponding to the glued manifold must be the composition of the two operators. So rather mathematically, you should think of this as a category where you obviously have manifolds with boundary. They're called cobordism. And the objects are the boundaries, so in one dimension less, and the morphism are manifolds with boundary, also called cobordism. And you have a composition which is gluing. You have to make this precise. And quantization, in this sense, is just a functor from this category to the category of Hilbert spaces or just vector spaces, if you want to avoid deeper discussion about analysis. Okay, this is more or less a rough idea. Then Segal's program was implemented successfully in the case of conformal field theory. And later on, Atiya realized that you can take this formalism and define topological field theory exactly this way, but introducing the extra axioms that the operator associated to a manifold with boundaries should be invariant under diffeomorphism that preserve the boundary. So this was his definition of topological field theory. And the typical example is Rashetikin-Turayev invariant for three manifolds. Okay, so here is what the big here. So to the boundaries we associate vector spaces, and to manifolds with boundaries should associate states or operators. If you don't work with Hilbert spaces, just let's go down to vector spaces. Then typically you can think of states, operators, all the states of the tensor product. So it's easier to use this language. Now, what happens if you want to do this with perturbative quantum field theories? One problem is typically that everything becomes perturbative. So basically, your Hilbert spaces are not Hilbert spaces. Usually, some vector spaces, some infinite dimensional vector spaces, and then you define these operators perturbatively. But there is another problem that arises. That so in most interesting theory, you have gauge symmetries, and the physical theory, in a sense, is defined modulo gauge symmetries. And for example, in the case of topological field theory, this is exactly the case. The Lagrangian version of topological field, like Rishetigin Turayev, is expected to be Chern-Simons theory, which is a gauge theory. And basically, what you do if you just analyze the theory, it turns out that the spaces, I mean, the description given by Atiyah, in some sense, corresponds to the theory modulo the symmetries. And the point that when you do this, the vector spaces you associate to the boundary become finite dimensional. But if you try to do the same starting directly from the field theory, you at the beginning you have some infinite dimensional spaces, essentially, for example, spaces of connections. And only after modding out the symmetries, you end up having finite dimensional spaces. And the point is that, okay, these quotients are usually not very nice. It's not the thing you want to do. So usually, in quantum field theory, perturbative quantum field theory, use other tricks, more homological tricks. Just go back to the oldest trick is the Fateyev-Potapov determinant that you can rephrase in a nicer way using the BRC language, or in a more modern and more flexible way, the BV formalism. So the result is that if you try to apply these, you end up actually associating to the boundary some complexes, not just vector spaces, typically some infinite dimensional complexes, but then what you're interested is in their cohomology. And in topological field theory, the cohomology turns out to be finite dimensional. Okay, so this is somehow the framework, the idea, what you want to do. Essentially the idea is how to recover Segal's axioms starting from a Lagrangian and try to make sense of perturbative expansions, including gauge symmetries. Okay, and actually this does not only apply to topological field theories, it applies in principle to every kind of quantum field theory. Of course, if your theory is not topological, typically you have issues with renormalization, so this has to be refined in order to understand how renormalization is coupled with boundary issues. So probably in the example, I will stick to topological field theory to illustrate some of the more algebraic or topological part of the formalism. Okay, so let me start with this very simple example of to see how this Segal program was also motivated from perturbative quantum field theory. So let me start with a theory without symmetries. So we might think of this just as a scalar field, for example. Could be free field or field interaction, but somehow the idea that formally you have some action that depends on some field, and typically one thing you do is to compute a partition function. We just integrate the exponential of the action times IH bar over all fields. But what happens if you have a boundary? So if you have a boundary, typically what happens is that you have some natural space of boundary fields. So here is my notation. Fm is a space of fields on the manifold M. You choose some manifold M. And F boundary of boundary M is the natural space associated to the boundary. We'll see later on how it works. But for example, if you think just in classical mechanics, typically, right, you just take the standard Lagrangian, right, kinetic energy minus potential energy. So the space of fields are just paths, and the space of boundary fields is just the cotangent bundle. More naturally, would be the tangent bundle of the target manifold. So the space of possible initial positions and initial velocities. So this boundary space has a symplectic structure. And so typically what you do, you choose some polarization. So for simplicity, let me assume that, as it's often the case, this boundary space of fields arises already. It's presented to you already as a cotangent bundle of some base manifold of fields. So basically, you think of some sort of Schrödinger quantization. So the vector space you want to associate to this symplectic manifold are functions on the space B. So since this is infinite dimensional, well, you cannot say square integrable function, you should find some good space of functions you want to consider. And then you have to produce a state. So a state is just a function on B. So you fix some phi, so some essentially some boundary field in this space B. And what you do, you integrate now the exponential of the action over all bulk fields with the property that on the boundary they restrict to this phi. So here notice that we have a projection map, or actually a restriction map, from bulk field to boundary field, and then you have the projection from the cotangent bundle to its base. So what you require is that this capital phi, the bulk field, is in the pre-image of these two maps, the composition of these two maps. So this gives you a natural definition of states, and typically you might think of having this gluing because in a sense, if I want to compute the states for the glued things, right, I should think integrate over all possible bulk fields, and basically you might think of having some sort of Fubini-type theorem for a functional integral in the sense that, well, instead of integrating directly over all bulk fields, I integrate over all bulk fields here with the condition that they match here, and then I integrate over the matching condition. Okay. Now, the point is that, most interesting Lagrangians are degenerate. They have symmetry, so you have to deal with them. And I think you're all familiar with BRBC formalism. Probably most of you are familiar also with the BV formalism, but just to make sure you can follow the rest, I will give a short introduction to the BV formalism. So this goes back to Bataling and Wilkowiecki. So this is some cohomological method to gauge fix gauge theories, in such a way that in appropriate sense you can make sure that the result is independent of the choice of gauge fixing. So just let me start with a finite dimensional description. So this is all mathematically sound, you don't have to make attention. And then the idea when you want to extend to the infinite dimensional case of field theory, you somehow take this motivation, try to mimic this in an infinite dimensional setting, and then try to make sense in some perturbative, in some regularized version. Okay, so the idea is the following. Let's just start in the local picture. We'll go move on to the global picture later on. So suppose that we have some local supermanifold, so some R and M. But because if you know what supermanifolds are, just means that basically you have coordinates, P and Q, and you consider the algebra generated by these coordinates. And the only difference between the usually usual manifold is that some of these coordinates are odd. And in this case, you just take the X0 algebra generated by them. So here, I do not insist that the Q are even and the P are odd. This is a bit mixed. Some of the Qs are even, some of the Q are odd. But the important point is that the momenta P are of opposite parity. So if some Qi is even, the corresponding Pi is odd, and vice versa. And then there is a natural operator you can define over here, which is called the BV Laplacian. Essentially, there's the second derivative with respect to conjugate coordinates, and there is some extra sign you have to put. So if all the Qs were even, there would be no sign. But since I'm taking a mixed version, you have to put these signs, and these will be compatible with our changing variables. There is also a more intrinsic definition of this delta, which also explains this sign, which is the following. Since I have an equal number of Q and P variables, so really thinking of having some symplectic structure, which I've written here, so you have some Poisson bracket associated to it, which is an odd bracket. And so in particular, you can define Hamiltonian vector fields. So the idea that you can define the BV operator delta on a function f by first computing the Hamiltonian vector field of your function f using this symplectic structure, and then up to this factor -1/2, you take this divergence. So of course, the divergence requires a notion of measure, right? And this is what the problem you have in the infinite dimensional setting. You have to make sense of the divergence. You can make sense of Hamiltonian vector fields, but you have to make sense of the divergence in some sense. And here also in this formula, you see what the problem would be in the infinite dimensional setting, namely that here this sum will become a series, and you have to make sense of that. Now, this delta is very nice, and it has two nice properties. So the first, which is almost obvious from this formula, is that it squares to zero. You just apply this delta square, you see that basically you multiply a symmetric by an anti-symmetric matrix, so the result must be zero. And another property you can check is that if you apply this delta to a function, you can distribute these derivatives. So you might take both derivatives of the first function, so you construct reconstruct delta on the first function, or you put both derivatives of the second function, so you reconstruct delta on the second function up to signs, or you can distribute them on the two functions, so the result is that you derive one function with respect to q and the other one with respect to p, so you reconstruct the Poisson bracket, the odd Poisson bracket. So in this setting, historically, the odd Poisson bracket is denoted by a round bracket instead of curly bracket, like in classical mechanics, but this is also good because it stresses that this is an odd bracket and not an even bracket. Okay. Now, the next important point is the so-called BV integral. So here I just give you the formula, and then later on we'll give you some geometric interpretation. So the ingredients are the following. So we are given a function f of all coordinates and an odd function of the q variables only. Okay? And then you define this integral that depends on the odd function psi as follows. Basically, you use the function psi, right, to define the p variables. So psi depends only on the q variables, and you say that the pi variables is the derivative of psi with respect to the corresponding qi variable, right? And you plug it in into your function. So now your function only depends on the q variables that you can integrate. Okay, so this is, now we have to play two things. Why do I use this notation L psi? Well, the point that geometrically you should think of this, setting the p is equal to the derivative of the psi, as defining some Lagrangian submanifold. So let me do just the one-dimensional example in the AVIF case. Suppose that you have a q variable here and the p variable here and some function psi. Then I said I want to take psi to be the psi with respect to the q, and this will give you some submanifolds of half the dimension, and the important point that if you restrict the symplectic form to this half dimensional manifold, you get zero. So this is what you would call a Lagrangian submanifold. And in particular, this is a kind of Lagrangian submanifold that you can project down to the submanifold where you set all the p's to zero. They call it projectable Lagrangian submanifold. Now, in the case of supermanifold, of course, you cannot draw curves. You don't have this geometric picture, but basically, you have the algebraic analog of it. So it's good to have this notation. And actually, in a sense, this is really Lagrangian submanifold, if you know what submanifolds or supermanifolds are. Okay, and the second thing I have to explain, what is this integration? So here, some of the variables are even and some of the variables are odd. For the even variable, it's the usual Lebesgue integration, and for the odd variable is the Bayesian integration. So probably you know what Bayesian integration is, otherwise something very, very, very simple just means that, okay, you have a function of some odd variables, so it's an element of X0 algebra. Bayesian integration means that you take the top component in this X0 algebra, you pick a basis to identify the top X0 algebra with your ground field, and this number you get is the integral. So it's nothing more than that. Okay. So of course, in this there are some choices in this integration. As I said, for the odd part, you have to choose a frame, essentially. And for the even part, you have to choose a measure, for example, the Lebesgue measure. And now there are two, there is an important lemma, which is a very, very simple exercise. I mean, I could do it like in half a blackboard, but we can discuss in the afternoon if you want to see it. Basically, it's the following. So here I assume that the integrals converge. Of course, since you have an even part, sometimes the integrals do not converge, but let me assume that they converge. So if they converge, you have these two important properties. If your function is delta exact, then its integral over every L size is automatically zero. And the second property is that if your function is delta closed, then your integral over some L psi is invariant under the formation of this psi. Okay, so in this geometric picture, it means that if instead of integrating over this curve, I integrate over a slightly different curve, I get exactly the same result. And this is an important point for the application in field theory. So we'll come later on, but somehow the idea is that you should think of this half-dimensional surface as your choice of gauge fixing, and this theorem tells you that you don't have to worry about this choice. Okay, and the proof is very, very simple. You just take this definition and check what happens to the integral. You use essentially Stokes' theorem, and that's it. Okay, so the application to field theory is the following. So typically, you are given some function, for example, the exponential of the action that you want to integrate, and you are given some, you rephrase this somehow in some odd symplectic manifold, we'll tell you later on, but somehow the idea is that typically, the thing is that you, on this odd symplectic manifold, you have some reference, Lagrangian sum manifold, which in this picture should be the zero section. This is somehow given to you by the problem, but the integral over this reference Lagrangian section is ill-defined. It does not converge. But on the other hand, you have been able to extend your function f outside this zero section in such a way that it is delta closed. So if you have been able to do this, then basically you say, okay, I define my integral over the zero section as the integral of some deformation of the zero section using some psi. So here would be, instead of integrating over the zero section, I integrate on something that deforms a little bit. And I choose a deformation such that the integral converges. And then the previous theorem says that, okay, you shouldn't worry about the chance of this deformation. Of course, the theorem says that the result is invariant under deformation. So globally, there might be different classes. So this might matter. But at least locally, it's okay. And often in physical theory, there is also some more natural choice of the class. Sometimes, not always, but often there is some more natural choice. Okay, now in the typical application, as I said, this function f is the exponential of the action. So now we introduce the h-bar parameter. And the point is that if you try to see what it means, delta f equal to zero for s, you end up with this equation. So remember that delta contains second derivative. So when you apply the second derivative to the exponent, you have a term where you derive it twice, and your term where you derive it once, and then you derive it again. So you can check, you get this equation. This is a so-called quantum master equation. And the advantage of writing delta f equal to zero in this form is that now h bar appears explicitly here in the numerator, not in the denominator. So this formula is more suitable to perturbation analysis. So namely, the idea is that typically you think s to be independent of h bar or to be some polynomial, some formal power series in h bar, but with no inverse powers of h bar. And then you see that if you make this assumption on s, you should use a different notation. So you assume that your S satisfies this equation, then the coefficient at order zero in H bar satisfies this simpler equation. So this should be somehow some S zero, so the H zero part of your action. And this is called the classical master equation. Now, what is the advantage of this? Well, the advantage is that this equation now makes sense also in the infinite dimensional setting. As I said, delta is harder to define because it requires some measure on your infinite dimensional space. So this is the whole problem you have in quantum field theory. And okay, to make sense of this equation, you typically have to resort to some regularization. Whereas this equation is usually intrinsically well-defined. Typically, you think of having some infinite dimensional manifold with this symplectic structure, this Poisson bracket, and you want to solve this equation. Of course, there is a minor issue that in the infinite dimensional setting, not every function possesses a Hamiltonian vector field, right? But this is contained in this equation. So this first assumption number one is that this function S has Hamiltonian vector field, and then you can compute this bracket, this has to be zero. So typically, if you work on manifolds without boundary and closed manifolds, and your action function is a local functional, as it is usually the case, and your symplectic structure is also local, then S has Hamiltonian vector field. So the only requirement that S bracket S is equal to zero. But we see that in the case you have a boundary, then you start having problem with this equation. Okay, so here is just what I said. The classical master equation makes sense also in the infinite dimensional case. Okay, maybe one slight generalization of the integral, BV integral uses a BV push forward. This is very important. It's important if you want to go to effective theories, a very important error normalization. It was used a lot also by Kevin. So let me just give you the finite dimensional version, which is very, very simple. Basically, the proof is essentially the same proof I didn't give for the BV integral, but it's again just half a Blackwood, very simple. So just let me explain the setting. So suppose that we are, again, we have this set of coordinate P and Q that are paired to each other. Some Qs are even, but then the corresponding P are odd and vice versa. And now it's, so I assume that I can split them into two subsets, some P prime paired to Q prime and some P second paired to Q second. So then I can write my symplectic form omega as a sum of a form omega prime for the perfect prime coordinates and omega double prime for the double prime coordinates. And then if you remember the formula for delta, you also see the delta splits as a sum of delta for the prime coordinates plus a delta for the double prime coordinates. So now the ingredients will be a function f of all coordinates, prime and double prime coordinates, and the function psi that defines the gauge fixing, which is now assumed to be odd as before, but it's assumed to depend only on the q double prime coordinates, not on the q prime. And then you define the BV push forward with respect to this psi. I will use some of the same notation, integral of psi. So this is done as follows. So you use psi to set the p double prime coordinate to be the derivative of psi with respect to the corresponding q double prime coordinate. So if you do this displacement, your function ends up to depend on p prime, q prime, and q double prime. Right? And then you integrate only over q double prime variables, and the result is a function of the p prime, q prime variables. And what you can check is that the delta operator actually commutes with this integral. So if you apply the delta for the prime variables after computing the integral, this is the same as applying the total delta before computing the integral and then integrating. And you have also some version of the formula I had before that said that the integral is invariant under deformation. Now, if you change your psi, say let psi depends on some parameter t, you compute the integral corresponding to some psi sometime t, and then you see how it changes when you change your psi. Well, it's no longer zero in general, but it's always a delta prime of something. So this is what you can check. So all of this tells you that essentially the delta homology is a relevant thing, right? The delta closed functions are the ones that have good properties, and the result of the fiber integration is well-defined modulo delta exact terms. Okay, so the typical application are, for example, you integrate out fast fields and get effective fields here after the normalizations, but okay, other applications. Okay, now let me come to the global version, which is also important. This basically was developed by several people. So, I mean, the original result by Battaglia and Vilcovis are probably only local, but then this whole story was generalized to super manifolds by several people, including several mathematicians. Probably Manning's book has some account of this, and Witten realized that this is somehow related to ordinary different cohomology. Schwarz more or less completed the picture, gave the full account. His paper is probably still the most up to date. Apart from one missing thing, that the observation that if you work on half density, which I mentioned in a moment, there is a canonical definition of this BV operator that does not require any choice. So this was observed by Kuda-Verdian and then explained some deeper level by Chimera. So for this, I have to assume that, okay, you have somehow some intuitive understanding of what a supermanifold is. So a supermanifold is somehow the simplest way to think of a supermanifold is, well, just take the usual definition of manifolds in terms of charts, but basically all the information you need to work with a manifold are given by transition maps from one chart to the other. Right? So you just have, say, in the case of smooth manifold, basically you have some charts, and then you have some diffeomorphism associated to intersection of charts, right? Changes of variables from one chart to the other. So in the case of super manifold, it's exactly the same. The only difference is that the change of variables now are diffeomorphisms of local super manifold, which means our smooth function tensor exterior algebra of some odd variables. So that's the only thing. So you have this notion of functions, which are smooth tensor exterior algebra. You extend it to many components. This gives you the notion of super of maps between local super domains. And then you require them to be invertible. These are super diffeomorphisms. And then you use them to define manifolds. OK. And there is a natural theory of integration on supermanifolds that mimics the natural theory of integration on manifolds. So if you remember, in the case of manifolds, what you do is, well, you know how to integrate on Rn or on domain in Rn, and you know how integral changes when you make a change of variables. The changes are just by absolute value of the Jacobian. Right? And then you use this information to define the natural object to be integrated. These are objects that look locally looks like functions, but they transform by the absolute value of the Jacobian. And these are the things that you can integrate. And the global integration is defined by integrating over charts, right? And summing over charts. So you use a partition unity to do that, but essentially this is the point. And here you have to can do the same. So the first thing you have to check is what is the change of variable theorem for integrals or super integrals. So I said before that the integral, when you have odd and even variables, is a mixture. You have essentially the Lebesgue integral and this Bayesian integral. So you have to check what happens if you make a change of variables. And it turns out that this changes by the so-called Bayesian. This is some other operator you can define on super matrices. I will not go into details, but so these are the generalization of the determinant. And then you have a notion of densities on supermanifolds. These are things that locally look like functions, but they transform with the Bayesian. And they can be integrated. Okay. The interesting thing is that if you have, now we want our supermanifold to be odd symplectic. Remember that one important ingredient was this odd symplectic form. We had this sum of dpdq. So we want this to be globally defined. So, well, this is not difficult. Say that an odd symplectic form in a supermanifold is just an odd closed two form, which is non-degenerate. And there is an important consequence of this. The important consequence is that densities on your total supermanifold automatically induce. Not density. So there are two consequences. The first thing is that densities transforms actually, essentially squared, Okay, so the important point that you have an odd symplectic manifold, densities have a well-defined square root, which is not obvious. Right? I mean, in ordinary manifold, a density is transformed with an absolute values, right? So positive number, you can take square roots, but here they transform with this Bayesian, so sometimes this can be, well, it's not even a function, it's not a number, and but can be negative, so you have to make sure, but on an odd symplectic manifold, this is always, in some sense, positive, so you can take the square root. So it's actually, you can see that the transformation is a positive function times some like 1 plus an expansion in the odd variable, so you can take the square root. So you have the notion of half densities, and the other important point that half densities give you densities on Lagrangian submanifolds. Somehow, this taking these square roots corresponds to taking somehow half of the variables. So these are a natural integration theory. So if you have a half density on your odd symplectic manifold, you can naturally integrate it on any Lagrangian submanifold. And the second important observation is that there is a canonically well-defined operator delta, which is defined on half density and which squares to zero. And when you go to local coordinate, is the delta I wrote at the beginning. And also this delta has the same property as for the local delta, namely, if your half density is delta exact and you integrate it on a Lagrangian, you get zero. And if your half density is delta closed and you integrate it on a Lagrangian, then you start deforming this Lagrangian, the result does not change. Maybe let me give you some motivation. This was more or less observed by Witten and worked out by Schwarz. So the idea is the following, that first of all, you have some sort of global Darboux theorem. You can represent every odd symplectic manifold as a cotangent bundle, where you reverse the parity of the fiber. And in this case, this is not canonical, but you can do it in the smooth setting. And the important point is that if you choose this M to be even, completely even, so just really a manifold, then it turns out that you have an identification between the half densities on the supermanifold F and the differential forms on the ordinary manifold M. And under this identification, this capital delta, this canonical operator on half density, is nothing else than the canonical Deram differential on differential forms. So that's why it's canonical. And then, this theorem reduces to Stokes' theorem if you consider a special class of Lagrangian submanifold, namely odd conormal bundle. So the idea that if you take a submanifold C of M, you take its conormal bundle, so these are the covector that kill all tangent vectors, you change the parity of the fibers, this becomes a Lagrangian submanifold of this odd cotangent bundle, and you can check that the integral of your half density over this Lagrangian submanifold is the same as the integral of the corresponding differential form on the submanifold. So then this theorem is just Stokes' theorem. But the interest is that actually there are more general Lagrangian submanifolds than just the odd conormal bundle. So that's why, I mean, you don't want to just to reduce to the usual language. Okay, and the global PD push forward is obtained as follows. So now we assume that your total odd symplectic manifold is a product of two odd symplectic manifolds, and you assume that you have a Lagrangian submanifold of the second factor, and the half density on the whole odd symplectic manifold, and then what you do, you integrate your half density on the Lagrangian submanifold, the second factor, and so the result is a half density on the first factor. And then you can check again that this delta operator commutes with this integration, and again that if your half density is delta closed and you change the Lagrangian submanifold, the result changes by that exact term, exactly in the local picture. Okay. Now, the bad thing about half densities is that they do not form an algebra. Right? If you multiply them, you have a density, not a half density. So for the reason, much nicer to work with functions. So for this, you need some identification between functions and half densities. So to do this, you typically choose a reference nowhere vanishing half density, right? And then you can identify half density with function just by multiplication. And so you can now transfer this delta operator to functions. So it's defined this way. If you have a function f, you multiply it with this nowhere vanishing reference half density, you apply the canonical delta, and then you divide by this half density because it's nowhere vanishing. So you can do it, you get back a function. And from this formula, you immediately see that this delta c is squared to zero. But we would like also to have this formula that we had locally. And for this, you have to require your reference half density to be delta closed. Actually, it's always possible to find delta closed half densities because of this identification with differential forms. And okay, so you choose half density, reference half density of this property, then your delta function has again this nice property. And so in particular, it turns out that if you apply this delta to an exponential, apart from the exponential factor, you get this. And so now if you have globally a function of the form exponential I over h bar s, and you want it to be delta closed, it's equivalent to solving this quantum master equation. And again, in lower order h bar, you can reduce it to the classical master equation.
When you say it's always possible, there's no global issues about it not vanishing?
About?
With the non-vanishing condition.
This row? No, because of this identification of an odd cotangent bundle of a manifold. So.
In the odd cotangent.
Yes. I mean, I assume everything to be for simply, I assume everything to be orientable and the fiber to be orientable. So this base manifold is orientable. So.
You're still in the.
Yeah. I assume everything to be orientable. So essentially, yeah, you can, yeah, you need orientability. Otherwise, you might not have a volume form, which you, essentially, you construct this row using some volume form on the base manifold, so you need the volume form to exist.
So, I mean, you're it's the infinity geometry.
And the infinity dimensional case, of course, you don't have the volume form in a sense.
But I mean, you're not even infinite dimensions. Like, if you were in complex analytic geometry,
then you wouldn't have this identification. Well, you would have this identification, but it would not be holomorphic. The whole mouth we met, but yeah. Yes, now of course, if you want to keep track of a complex structure, then of course things change. Yes, sure. Okay, now let's come to some bookkeeping. So typically in field theory of some additional Z grading, it's very good to have it. So now we'll move to this refined version. So the idea that our coordinates have some degree in Z, they're not just even and odd, they have some additional degree, which is called the Gauss number in physics. And this Z grading is assigned in such a way that the function, your action, has degree zero. So degree zero corresponds to physical variables. So you want your function to have degree zero. And in addition, you want its Hamiltonian vector field Q, so it's defined by this equation. You want the Hamiltonian vector field to have degree plus one, I mean, you might also choose it to be minus one, but one or two choices, because you want it to be some sort of a cohomological operator, some differential. So these two conditions tells you that your omega must have degree minus one. So this fixes the degrees. And with so short, when physical theory usually have these degrees, I will show you how to recover this Z grading if you start just from gauge theories. Now, if you introduce this cohomological vector field Q, you might see that the classical master equation, that is a condition that the Poisson bracket of S with itself is zero, is equivalent to the condition that Q Lie commutes with itself. Okay? And I mean, this is just a well, classical fact. You also have in symplectic geometry, in usual symplectic geometry, well, this thing would be is up to constants. But in this case, you might see that because of degree reason, you don't have constants. Okay, so if you think as the action of Q on functions, so Q is a vector field, so in particular it acts on functions as a derivation, it's a derivation of degree one, which squares to zero, so it's a differential. So usually this Q is called a cohomological vector field, and in physics is often referred to as a BRST operator. Okay, so let me now give you an example. So first in these slides, I will describe it in the physical language, and the next slide will describe it in more mathematical language. So suppose that you have a gauge theory. So what does it mean to have a gauge theory? So this means that you have a manifold, for example, possibly an infinite dimensional one, a space of fields that is denoted by F sub m, and you have some action functional, SM0, some gauge group acting on this manifold, and the condition that this function is invariant. Okay? So you can all take a finite dimensional example if you like. Now, so what you do to express this cohomologically is to move to the so-called BRST formalism. So if you don't know it, I define it here. In the next slides, I will give some more mathematical characterization. So let me denote by phi the field. So these are coordinates on this Fm. And what you do, you introduce the Gauss C. So these are coordinates on the parity reversed Lie algebra. So some odd coordinate on your Lie algebra, and then you define the BRST operator delta. So okay, if you've seen it in physics, you know what it is, otherwise the next slide will be. So but typically you have some operator delta that square to zero, and here the natural degrees are zero for the physical fields, because they're physical, and plus one for the Gauss. And then you introduce their momenta to cook up this symplectic structure, and since you want it to be the degree minus one, they say the moment of the classical fields must have degree minus one, the moment of the Gauss must have degree minus two, and the moment of the fields must be odd, and the momenta of the Gauss must be even. And then you just define this extended action, you just take your classical action, and you add this thing where you pair the momenta to the BRST operator applied to the corresponding variable. And this is the symplectic form corresponding to this choice. And then you can check that if your manifold is closed, then the classical this S class satisfies the classical master equation. Or more generally, if you didn't have this assumption, you might see that the classical master equation corresponds exactly to this assumption, namely having an action and the classical condition that your action is invariant. So the mathematical description is the following. So we have a manifold F and Lie algebra G acting on it and the G invariant function. So now change the notation, please call it small s. Then you can associate the Chevalier-Eilenberg complex to this. You might think of functions on F as a module for your Lie algebra. And then you have the associated Eilenberg differential, Chevalier-Eilenberg differential. So this is co-chains are maps from the zero algebra of G dual to functions. But you might think of all of them as function on the super manifold. So you multiply your original manifold F by the odd version of the algebra. So function on the odd version of the algebra is precisely the serial algebra of G dual. Right? So this Chevalier-Eilenberg differential is a differential. So in particular, it squares to zero. Or if you regard it as a vector field over here, it Lie commutes with itself. And then what you do, you just take the cotangent bundle of this. Oh, this should be a minus one. You shift it by minus one to get this symplectic structure of degree minus one. And then the first thing you can do, you can lift this vector field. So you have a vector field on the base. And you can always regard it as a function that is linear on the fiber. So this is this function delta hat. Right? So when I have a cotangent bundle, every vector field of the face gives rise to a vector field that is linear on the fiber. You just pair the components of the vector field with the fiber coordinates. Right, so this is the function delta hat, and actually the point is that the Hamiltonian vector field of this function delta hat in the horizontal part gives you back delta, and then it's some vertical part. Okay, and now you define the BV action capital S as the sum of this delta hat plus the pullback of your classical action S to this Cartesian bundle. And again, you can check that, if you really have an action, and if small s is invariant, then this capital S satisfies the classical master equation. Okay. Now, if you move to the quantum master equation, it means that you have to introduce now some measure on F and on G. And typically, you can see that solving the quantum master equation contains the additional information that the action preserves the measure. So that's some axis formation. Okay. So now let's go back to the general theory. So general theory, classical setting, we have an odd symplectic manifold F with some odd symplectic form omega. It might be infinite dimensional if you need to. And then we have a function S, an even function S of degree zero that Poisson commutes with itself. Then we said that we introduced a Hamiltonian vector field Q. So I mean, Q acting on function is just a Poisson bracket of S with a function, or using the differential geometric language, Q is a unique vector field with the property that when you contract it with omega, you get the differential of the function, right? And then the classical master equation is equivalent to this condition. So now you can replace this condition by these two conditions. This is absolutely equivalent. And now the idea that, okay, we want to weaken this a little bit, because typically in the application, this S will be a local functional on a manifold with boundary, right? To check these properties, you have to integrate by parts. So typically integrate by parts here. When you want to compute the differential of your actual functional, that's where you have, but basically you take functional derivatives, and that's the point where you integrate by parts. So this equation will be spoiled on manifolds with boundary. So now we'll just give you some abstract mathematical theory, forgetting at the moment the application. So the idea is that I want to weaken this setting. So basically the idea is that I keep some super manifold F, some close to form omega. I no longer insist that it is non-degenerate. The reason for dropping this is that, for example, if you want to apply this theory to finite dimensional version of quantum field theory on manifold with boundary, you have to drop the condition that omega is non-degenerate. So let me do it already. And the second thing is that I drop this condition. So I no longer require that Q is a Hamiltonian vector field of S. Okay? So the setting now is that we have super manifold F, a closed out to form degree minus 1 omega, and some even function S of degree 0 with no condition, and an odd vector field Q of degree plus 1 Lie-commuting with itself. These are the data. Now, since this equation is not no longer satisfied, I want to measure how wrong it is. So I define this alpha check to be this difference. Right, so you can check from here, this alpha check is a one form, it is even, and it has degree zero. Right? So in the true BV case, this alpha check is equal to zero, now with some form defined for you by the setting. Okay, now since we want to do some symplectic geometry, the natural thing is to take the differential of this one form. So this will be some closed even two form of degree zero, typically degenerate. But now the interesting thing is that automatically you see that Q preserves this omega check. Q in general does no longer preserve omega, but it preserves this new two-form omega check. And actually, using the Z grading, you can see that it's even more is true. This Q is actually Hamiltonian. So actually there is a uniquely defined odd function S check, which has degree plus one, satisfying this property. Contracting Q with omega check gives you the differential of S check. Okay? Notice that this is a highly non-trivial statement because this omega check is typically degenerate. Okay? Moreover, you can check that if you contract Q twice with omega and divide by 2, you get this function S check. So this is also one way to compute this function S check. And the point is that morally, you can interpret this double contraction of a Hamiltonian of Q with omega as some way of defining the Poisson bracket of S with itself. So if Q were the Hamiltonian vector of fields of S, this double contraction would be exactly the Poisson bracket vessel itself. So now you can take this well-defined expression as the replacement for the master, classical master equation. So somehow this tells you that the classical master equation is violated by this canonically defined term S check. Okay, now we want to do symplectic geometry, so I want to mod out by the kernel of these two forms. So to keep things nice, I make two assumptions. So I assume that, the kernel of a two form is an involutive distribution. I make the assumption that it's regular, so it has constant rank. And I also make the assumption that the quotient that which I will denote by F boundary is a smooth manifold. Okay, so this simplifies the discussion, and this typically happens in field theories. Yes?
Topological theories, like maybe AKS Z type,
yes?
Is omega check typically non-degenerate?
No, this omega check is degenerate. Practically always degenerate. The omega you get from AKZ is a reduction of this omega check. You see, an example. Okay, so this assumption that this reduced space is smooth is what typically happens in field theories is not a big assumption. A stronger assumption that is often not true is that this one form alpha check is basic. Okay, so on the quotient, the two form is basic by construction. So you have a symplectic structure on the quotient whose pullback is omega check. But to simplify the notation, I make the assumption that already the potential, this one form, descends to the quotient. This is not true in general, and you can deal with that, but the formula becomes more complicated, so I will not do it. But there are a lot of physical examples where it is the case that this alpha check does not descend directly. Okay, so under this assumption, what happens? Well, we now have a new supermanifold F boundary, and on this supermanifold, we have an even one-form alpha boundary, and its differential omega boundary, and the pullbacks of alpha boundary and omega boundary are precisely alpha check and omega check. Moreover, since Q is a Hamiltonian, it turns out to be projectable. So this means that there is a uniquely defined vector field on the quotient. I will denote it Q boundary. Such that they are related. So basically, you can project Q to the quotient, and you get this Q boundary. And of course, since this projection preserves the bracket, so Q boundary will also recommute with itself. And in addition, again, because of Z grading, there is a uniquely defined odd function S boundary on the quotient, such that Q boundary is its Hamiltonian vector field. Okay. So let me summarize what you have here. So we, out of this data, so we started just with F, omega, S, and Q, right? Where omega is a odd closed to form, degree minus one, S is just a function of degree zero and even, Q is an odd vector field degree plus one, decommuting with itself. So basically the only assumption that omega is closed and Q decommutes with itself. Out of it, we produce this new data, F boundary, omega boundary, S boundary, and Q boundary. And the condition now is that omega boundary is an even symplectic structure of degree zero. And Q boundary commutes with itself, and in addition, it's Hamiltonian. Okay? So this is called the BFV formalism from Battaglini, Frattini, and Wilkowiski. It was developed independently to study a different problem, namely how to describe symplectic reduction cohomologically, the typically symplectic reduction you get on field theory when you consider a boundary. But now it's interesting that you see this arise algebraically just from this data. For the moment, I didn't even speak of boundary. I mean, I use a notation with boundary because this will be related to the boundary of a field theory, but at the moment, this is just some purely algebraic constructor starting from here. Notice that there is a relation between these two spaces, namely the projection pi. And we have a projection pi from F to F boundary, right? Right? Because this F boundary is a reduction. Yes?
That's a question elaborating on what Dylan asked. So if we start with the bulk theory and the BV formalism,
yes,
which has all the fields, all the domains,
yes,
everything, non-degenerate structures,
yes,
then we can take the germs along the boundary of,
exactly,
the equations of motion,
yes,
which will have a non-degenerate structure.
Yes.
And will this be the same as what you find?
It will be a non-degenerate odd symplectic structure.
I was thinking there's like I mean, like, as Dylan was saying, suppose your theory was topological in the time
yes.
direction.
Yes.
And if you take your germs, you just, you know, you just set those fields to be constant.
Yes.
And then you find some non-degenerate even structure.
Yeah, there's, yeah. There's yeah, this is the result of the reduction, yeah.
That's the same
thing. Yeah, yeah, yes. Right. Yes. Yeah. Okay, so in addition, remember, so you have this projection pi from F to its reduction, F boundary, and in addition, you have this equation now, right? So remember that we defined alpha check as this difference, but now we saw that, well, alpha check is a pullback of this alpha boundary, so we can rephrase it this way. So this is somehow the crucial relation that relates the broken BV formalism here with the boundary BFV formalism. Okay? And this relation is somehow the important one, and this is the one that well, we are able to quantize in several examples. Okay, so just let me mention the notation. So this setting here is called BFV formalism, and well, this broken BV formalism together with this relation is what we call the BV-BFV formalism. Now let me just let me notice some interesting fact that well, in principle, since we are in principle only interested in the symplectic geometry, we can change this alpha boundary by an exact term, right? That the symplectic structure will not change. So well, the point that this is inconsistent with this equation, unless you also change S. You see, if you add delta of a function to this alpha boundary, you can reabsorb it into a redefinition of S. So basically, you just have to subtract the pullback of this F here, right? So now you have this, how this is the gauge group acting on the theory, and this also is interesting because this gives you like the correct interpretation of this object. See, it basically says that, okay, this one form is defined up to exact term, so its natural interpretation, there should be a connection for some line bundle, and direction functional has to change this way, so it's to be related to a section, but more precisely, its exponential should be regarded as a section of some, basically, the pullback of this line bundle. Okay, and this actually is also consistent with the situation where this alpha check does not descend to the quotient. The point that the correct interpretation that you should not impose the one form alpha check to descend to the quotient, but the connection alpha check to descend to the quotient. Now that's the important point. Okay, and now let me come to the, well, the application to field theory. This is, well, close to what you're saying, with slightly different language. So the idea is the following. So we start with some field theory, for example, the gauge theory. Let's suppose that we have already reformulated in the BV setting. So this means that for every closed manifold M, we have a space of fields Fm, which are some local nature, so typically sections of vector bundles, connections, maps, and things like that. And then we have our BV action, which is a function of degree zero, and it's even and it's local, which means it's an integral over the manifold of some Lagrangian density that is just defined in terms of the fields and their derivatives at each point, and a local symplectic structure over omega m. So again, local in the same meaning, and it has to be odd, degree minus one, closed, and non-degenerate in, well, in the appropriate sense. Okay? But in addition, you want Sm to satisfy the classical master equation. Now, you can compute the Hamiltonian vector field Qm of Sm, and since both S and omega are local, this will also be local, right? And it will decommute with itself, okay? And now the point is that, okay, if your manifold has boundary, right, since everything is local, so everything is just defined, right, around points, right? You recover the manifold just because you integrate over the manifold, right? But everything is local, so then you can extend this data to manifolds with boundary. You just take literally the same expression for omega m, sm, and qm, right? And the point is that now this equation will be broken, right? Because typically, since if s depends also on derivatives of the field, right? When you compute that s, you have to integrate by parts. So before, you ignore boundary term because there was no boundary, but now you have to keep track of them. So now this equation is broken. And so typically what you do is that you apply what I just described. So you will get some new supermanifold as boundary of boundary M, which has this B induced BFE structure. Now, the point, yeah?
The sort of your K from before is something like, so it was a distribution, so it's sort of like variations that vanish on the boundary. Is that right?
Not only. I mean, if you do it this way, they also basically you can change all bulk fields as well, right? Because since this equation was satisfying in closed manifold, right, all the errors you have are on the boundary. So in particular, each variation in the bulk is in the kernel of this two-form omega check.
If it sort of vanishes out of the boundary.
Yes, exactly. So, but this also means that you can reformulate it in a different way. So somehow you can first mod out essentially by all bulk fields, which means you just consider germs or jets of boundary fields, as Kevin was suggesting. And then somehow you can split this reduction into a two-step process. So first you forget the bulk fields, so you just see jets at the boundary, and then you do some reduction on the space of jets at the boundary. And doing this reduction corresponds essentially to constructing this even symplectic structure.
And it somehow recovers the Cauchy data correctly.
Exactly.
If you just throw away bulk fields, you still think you mean infinitely much Cauchy data.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Well, Cauchy data, actually true Cauchy data, yeah. Maybe just, okay, let me just make two remarks. Yeah. Well, this boundary space of fields is, I mean, the natural space of fields associated to your theory. But it's not all possible Cauchy data. Usually it's more, right? Somehow it depends what you mean by Cauchy data, right? Cauchy data are initial conditions, right? And in this space of fields, typically there are fields that cannot be integrated to solutions. Because I mean, if your theory is degenerate, basically there are constraints on the boundary. So this contains more.
Before or after reduction? Sorry, the final?
Also after reduction, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this contains still too many fields. So typically, the space of Cauchy data is related to the zero locus of a Q-boundary. Okay. So the zero locus of Q-boundary actually is a quasi-tropic submanifold, and essentially it really corresponds to the boundary fields that can be integrated to solutions. So these are the two Cauchy data. And well, this is a quasi-tropic submanifold, so basically the physical Cauchy data are in the reduction of these quasi-tropic submanifolds, which is usually horribly singular. So that's the singular reduction you get in field theory. But point that here, you don't have to do the reduction because basically everything is formulated homologically in terms of this Q-boundary. So you replace the bad geometric reduction by a good homological theory. Okay. And then one next observation is that now this construction becomes self-similar. I mean, the algebraic construction it did basically was just one step. You start from a broken BV theory and you get this associated BFE theory. But if you apply this to field theory, now you have a space of boundary fields, which is a BFE manifold. And typically, well, this is not a theorem, but typically these data are again local. I mean, it's not a theorem, but basically in all examples, the locality is so strong that this is again expressed in terms of local fields. So you see, before doing the reduction, clearly the jets on the boundary are local data, but in principle the reduction might spoil this, but this typically does not happen. So this space F boundary is again a space of local data, and omega boundaries, boundary, Q boundary usually are still local. So this means that now you may ask yourself, okay, what happens if my boundary has a boundary, which corresponds to having originally a manifold with corner. And now what you can do, you can apply the same construction I described, starting from the BFV data, and then you get some analogous structure on the boundary of the boundary with one extra shift. So there's the symplectic structure will be odd again, but degree plus one, and in principle you can keep going.
But in practice, if you try to do this, you can do it once as long as you're waiting as elliptic.
Yes.
But if you try to do it once more, you'll get like something incredibly degenerate unless you're...
It can be, yeah. Yes.
And if you start with the topological theory...
Topological theory, yeah, well, typically you can go down to...
If you
yeah.
start with just a Laplacian, you can only do it once.
Yes. Well, you can do one more step, but you're going to become zero.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so typically, okay, one thing that might happen is that you get a singular reduction or you get no local data, so that's very bad. Typically, this does not happen, but what typically happens is that at some point, maybe well, one step or two step, you get a completely trivial structure. I mean, your S become trivial. So you can continue getting trivial. But of course, the interest of doing this reduction is somehow keeping track of somehow the dimensionality. I mean, how many fields you have. So the things are very nice. Typically, basically, okay, when you move from one dimension to the lower one, right? Typically, what happens or what is good to happen is that you want the fibers modulo symmetry, say modulo Q, to be finite dimensional. So that's somehow the good situation, right? And whenever the things degenerate, what happens is that this fiber becomes infinite dimensional. So this means that, well, it doesn't help much to go that step further. Now you have some infinite dimensional fiber that you don't know how to deal with. Okay. So in topological field theory, what is nice is that you can keep going down, keeping, and you keep having finite dimensional reduced fibers up to dimension zero. So essentially this tells you that somehow the content of the topological field theory is really finite dimensional. But if you do it with other theories, this does not happen. As Kevin mentioned, if you just typically do it for a non-gauge theory, that's a scalar theory, this steps already breaks down when you try to move from the boundary to the boundary of boundary. If you do it for a Jahn-Mills theory, actually you can do one step further, and then you're stuck there, which means that, okay, you have some better situation, but in particular, it means that if you start in two dimensions, if you do Jahn-Mills theory in two dimensions, you can really go down to the point, as if it were a topological field theory. I mean, it's known that it's all about topological, but here you see it from another viewpoint. Okay, and for gravity, we still don't know. I mean, that's some hard exercise. We'll try to see what happens on the boundary of the boundary and at which point it breaks down. I mean, gravity in three dimensions is fully topological, so you know you can go down to dimension zero, but gravity in four dimensions, which of course more important was for a lot of people working here, I think we still don't know what happens. I mean, the computation becomes a bit harder, but yeah, we're trying to do that.
Do you know for kind of chiral conformal field theories, what this data looks like?
Higher dimensional?
Chiral conformal. Like if you use sort of a non-degenerate chiral conformal
field
theory,
like the
D-bar
operator.
Yes.
The D-bar operator can only do it once.
Yes.
So it seems like,
yeah.
It's about how
yes.
Is your operator?
Yes.
How many?
So you can go down once.
Yes.
Once.
Yes.
So yeah,
yes.
I was just asking basically what the data actually looks like what this stuff maybe looks like for a beta gamma system.
Oh, but the phase space is the one you would know. It's a tangent space. It's a column of oceans on the.
Yes. Okay, maybe shall we try to finish a bit of time? So one little remark here is that what I describe here is somehow the natural way to proceed. You just take your bulk theory and you just say, okay, your theory of the manifold boundary is the same. Of course, this is a choice, actually. And the point that you want this choice to be compatible with what we are describing. And the point is that, I mean, once you make this choice, right, the theory produces for you some BFV structure on the space of boundary fields. The BFV structure describes the reduction of some coisotropic submanifold. And you want this reduction to be really the physical content of the theory. The point that you can approach your theory from another point of view, just take the classical theory and try to understand what is the space of Cauchy data. Right? There are other geometrical things you can do. And then, you want the two things to match. You want the Cauchy data for the classical theory to be really related to the BFV theory you construct this way. And this is what typically happens with this naive approach, but not necessarily the case. There are some examples where you can see that this is not the case. So what you have to do in this example is to define the theory in the case you have the manifold with boundary by putting some strange boundary conditions, for example, on some Gauss. Right? But then you can apply the whole machinery and you get the correct BFV description. I mean, there is one nice example in one dimension where you can see this happens. And I mean, we have some version of gravity in four dimensions. This might happen, but it depends also how you formulate it. I mean, there is one hidden thing I didn't say here that, there is some symplectic geometry behind. So typically everything is invariant under symplectic homomorphism. So the BV structure is described in an invariant way. But the point is that when you go to the boundary, when you try to do these things, then things change. Right? If you just take the opposite description I gave, if I apply a symplectomorphism to the original theory, this changes the resulting BF theory completely. And if you think in terms of field theory, when things become infinite dimensional, if you, for example, do some symplectomorphism that depends on the derivatives of the fields, you really change the boundary structure completely. And actually, well, there are examples. Actually, this thing is a bit weird. There are examples where doing some bulk symplectomorphism, which means that okay, the bulk theory is the same, produces boundary theory that are so different that in one of them the reduction to F boundary is smooth, and in the other one is singular. So these are really says that somehow you have to be careful what it means when the true theory is invariant under well good symplectomorphism related to the boundary. So if you are not careful, you change completely the boundary structure, and you can move from singular to non-singular situations. So this means that typically it might start with some theory and get some singular structure on the boundary, but this singular structure is just an artifact of your wrong choice of some coordinates for the bulk theory.
Is there like a locality constraint in your notion of symplectomorphism?
Yeah, I want it to be local. Yeah, sure. Want everything to be local, but still, if the transformation depends on the derivative of the field, right, then this, for example, this equation changes. I mean, the boundary term for this equation change. And they might change in such a way that your omega check, the kernel of omega check is more or less singular. I mean, this again, you can see it in a simple one-dimensional example. Okay, so maybe I can stop here or just give one more slide with one example. I mean, would you prefer? I mean, probably it's good to have this example since I presented the theory, and then we can stop. Okay, this example is just Abelian-Yamil theory, Maxwell's equation, just to show you how this construction works explicitly. So that is not, I mean, formalism, of course, the general formalism like is involved, but when you apply to examples, typically not so bad. So, okay, let's start with Maxwell's equation. So let me present it in the more mathematical version. So the content of electromagnetism for me is just a connection, one form, and Maxwell's equation is just equation d star dA equal to zero. Right? You have some reference metric in your theory, so you have the Hodge dual of D, and these are the equation of motion. These are Maxwell's equation. Now it's easier. I mean, it's not necessary, but it's easier for presented this in one single slide to move to the so-called first-order formalism. So for the formalism, you introduce one auxiliary field B, which is a D minus two form. D is a dimension of space-time, and as a classical action, you take this action. You take B wedge dA, right? A is a one form, D is a two form, B the D minus two form, so this is a top form. And then you add this other term, one half B wedge Hodge dual of B. Okay? So here where the metric is hidden, so this is the term that makes the theory non-topological. Right? Now if you look at the other Lagrange equation for this action, you see that when you take the variation with respect to A, you get dB equal to zero. And when you take the variation with respect to B, you get that star B is equal to dA. So here you see that B is completely determined by A. So this auxiliary field is irrelevant, is completely recovered by A. And then when you plug in this into the second equation, you recover this equation. Okay? So classically, these two theories are completely equivalent. Now you can go to the BV setting. So here you have gauge transformation. You can change A by an exact one form. And so this is rephrasing the fact that I have some BRST operator that shifts A by DC. So in this BRST construction, what I have to do is to pair this BRST transformation DC to the momentum of A. So I have to add this extra term A dagger DC. See? And in this case, in the Abelian case, there is no transformation on B. So here, this actually depends on more fields. So it depends on A, B, this is a new extra field C, and then all the momenta. You have A dagger, B dagger, and C dagger, but only A dagger appears explicitly. Okay, and here is the symplectic form. Okay, now you can compute Q, right? This BRST operator on all fields, so you just have to take like a functional derivative. So, for example, to compute Q on A, you have to take the functional derivative with respect to A dagger, so you get DC, so you recover the gauge transformation. Right? But then you can compute Q on all other variables. So for example, if you want to compute Q of A dagger, then you have to take the functional derivative with respect to A, and so you get dB. right, and so on. So you see that this BRST operator contains at the same time the gauge transformation, but also the equation of motion. So this is a typical feature of the BV formalism. Somehow the idea that, well, the cohomology of Q gives should give you the Euler Lagrange space modulo gauge transformation. So that's to contain both equation of motion and the symmetries. Okay, now you go to the boundary. Now on the boundary, you should take jets of all the fields, right? And the point is that, well, you have a problem with integration by part because of these two terms, right? So if you check your alpha check, turns out to be the integral of the boundary of B times the variation of A plus a dagger times the variation of C. Right? These are the boundary terms coming when you try to. You take variation of A and integrate by part, or you can take a variation of C and integrate by part. So, but as you see, in this alpha boundary, only the restriction to the boundary of A, B, C, and the dagger appear. So basically, all the rest is in the kernel. So you mod out all the rest. So basically, after the reduction, the coordinates on your space F boundary are just A, B, A dagger, and C on the boundary. Okay? So, but this comes from reduction. So now you have this space of boundary fields with this one form and the corresponding symplectic structure, which is now non-degenerate. And now you can compute the projection of Q. So basically, you see that, well, you have to apply Q to these fields, right? So for example, you apply Q to A dagger, you know that it's dB, and then you project that to the boundary, so it's still dB. You apply Q to A, you get dC, and it's the same. But for example, if you apply Q to B, this was zero already, and QC was zero, so you don't have the PR. So in this case, the projection is also very simple to compute. In other examples, it's a bit more complicated. So now we have this boundary BFV structure. So the boundary fields are AB and A dagger and C. The symplectic structure pair A and B, and then you raise something with these other fields. So now what is the physical interpretation? So the physical interpretation is that the physical fields of the boundary are A and B. And if you want to relate them to usual language, you should think of A as a vector potential and B as the D minus one, D minus two form corresponding to the electric vector field. So these are the physical fields of the boundary. But there are still symmetries, right? There is this Q. So in particular, Q appears here, right? You say dB and dC. So one of the two things you should see as an equation of motion. So basically, you should impose a condition dB equal to zero. So if you rephrase it in terms of the vector field, it's just divergence of the vector field equal to zero. So this is Gauss equation. So this defines the causotropic submanifold, and you still have the gauge transformation. So this is boundary BFV structure tells you that the correct space of Cauchy data is given by vector potential and electric field. The electric field must satisfy the Gauss constraints, and you have to work modulo gauge transformation. So you recover the usual structure. And I think probably give, no, didn't give, but somehow here you can do the exercise and see what happens if you go to the boundary of the boundary. And you see there is something because this S is not zero and still contains a derivative. So on the boundary of the boundary, you still see C and B, and you have a one form C delta B, and the structure is nice. And in this case, the fiber model gauge transformation is finite dimensional. The non-abelian case is very similar. You have more term, but you can deal with it. Okay, I think I stop here because tomorrow you can start already with quantization. So let's finish the classical part. And tomorrow will be shorter. So, yeah, push a bit more so I can discuss.